The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Tech Weekly podcast from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's podcast, we're looking at how the web is transforming one of the most important aspects of human society, how we tell stories. We use storytelling as the glue to keep us together. They speak volumes about our hopes, our desires, our rules, our responsibilities. And the internet and the proliferation of new consumer and network technologies have not only changed the mode through which we spin yarns, but their meanings too. So we'll be speaking with author Frank Rose about the new art of immersion and what the editor of Wired magazine expects to see in the future. Joining me along this yellow brick road is digital storyteller Tim Wright and Guardian's digital media correspondent Jemima Kish. Welcome both to the studio. Now, Tim,
hello.
I hope you don't mind that I've called you a digital storyteller.
Well, I've been called worse.
You have, I know that. But you spent quite a career repurposing classic literature, often when it's out of copyright, which is an interesting question in and of itself, but using digital tools. So you've done Romeo and Juliet, Thomas Hardy, most recently. What would The Emperor's New Clothes by Hans Christian Andersen look like if he was writing now with access to all of the tech today? Would there be an augmented reality app, for example?
I really like the idea of intelligent fabrics and the idea that you're, which are coming down the line. That they're... They might be able to change colour or become transparent as you wear them, but also beam messages onto them, and so you could be your own walking billboard.
You could, couldn't you?
Well, they could telepathically represent the projections of the person looking at the clothes.
Whoa, that's getting really meta. Can you imagine that? That would just be like this kind of crazy 10,000 people as the emperor is going down the route, and all of these people's ideas being broadcast onto the clothing.
That's very good that I could put slogans onto your T-shirt.
Should we copyright that right now?
Quick.
Yeah, I always wanted to be able to text that onto other people's T-shirts. They've got blank ones. My favourite one would be, this conversation will lead to sex.
Well, I asked this yesterday on Twitter. And people said to me that I needed to get a life. Well, thank you very much. I've got a podcast. Thank you very much. Paranoid Marvin had the best response. He said, "You require Flash 9 or higher to view the new clothes." Yeah, I really like that.
10 house points.
Well, also in this week's podcast, we're looking at the numbers that lie behind Cisco's decision to scrap the flip camera and whether it will be a loss for content creators. Have smartphones eradicated the standalone media industry? And we will also be dissecting the announcement from the music streaming service Spotify about their latest adjustments to their customer subscription model. Has the music industry finally found a way to put enough pressure on the company to get them to step in line? Or is Spotify under duress from competing services like Amazon's recently announced Cloud Player and Google's and Apple's rumored forthcoming products? Keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. When it launched in 2007, the Flip was the most user-friendly way to upload video to the web. The handheld camera recorded up to 60 minutes of high-quality clips, later even in HD, and had an integrated USB port, simple software, and an incredibly achievable price point. It was, unsurprisingly, a huge success. In July 2009, Flip's Europe, Middle East, and Africa chief, Ray Sangster, met Charles and answered his questions about the threat from video recording mobile phones.
Competition is good. Competition is healthy. Mobile phones, fantastic technology. But what we're able to demonstrate is, and you know, I challenge you, take the mobile phone out of your pocket and I can switch this camera on in 3 seconds. I can take a 5-second clip and I can send it as an email or onto a social networking site within 5-6 seconds and have it anywhere in the world.
What, does it have Wi-Fi? But it doesn't have Wi-Fi built in.
No, but I can connect it to my laptop, which is connected.
But that needs you to have the laptop.
You don't pay £35, £40, £45 a month to use a Flip. People who are using Flip are not associating it with a mobile phone. They're socially networking today with a laptop, with a desktop. And it crosses all boundaries from preteens to grandparents.
Well, Sangster went on to answer criticisms of a lack of features by suggesting models with Wi-Fi and external microphone connections would be coming soon. However, 14 months later, when Charles caught up with the head of consumer sales UK at Cisco Systems, Gareth Jones, he asked why those features still weren't available. and compared it to a similar product by Kodak, which was better specified.
The great mass of people who want to buy the products don't want to buy anything that's over-specified. Camcorders bang technology into a tin box and then try to sell the benefits afterwards. Undoubtedly, I'm sure that the Kodak product is going to have technology soon that'll connect it with the Hubble telescope, but frankly, people don't want that. What you want and what you
see... They really want to have a less convenient way of doing it, seems to be what you're saying.
Well, what they see is much more convenient. Now, Kodak for the last 2 years have been trying to do a flip, and every single time they miss the basic stools of flip success, which is ease of use, the flip-out USB arm, simplicity, the FlipShare software that's on every camcorder. All our products are designed with consumer input behind, based on what they've experienced to date with the Flip products. And the biggest part about their demand for improvement is not some techie bit of junk on the hardware. It's basically on the software. The software is what they find extremely important. They want to share the videos. They don't want to have fun or get an orgasmic experience from capturing it with face recognition. That doesn't matter to the great unwashed. What they want to do is capture moments, share moments.
If all the products that you make are done with consumer input, why haven't they had an external microphone jack, which people have been saying it needs for pretty much since they came on the scene?
There's a tiny percentage of people who say they want it. We have now facilitated that by saying, here it is with the Flip port. So that tiny percentage wanted.
Gareth Jones from Flip. And you can hear those two interviews again. The link is on your iPod screen now or at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Now, it's only 4 years later, but Cisco has announced that they will be discontinuing the series. Jemima, why?
Well, there's various speculation about this, not least that it will allow Cisco to focus on its core networking business, which makes you think, well, why the hell did you buy a consumer video product in the first place? And as you started mentioning, it's hard to remember, but you know, 3-4 years ago, quite how what an impact the Flip made. It was an incredibly powerful consumer tool. Whether it's Cisco's fault that they didn't really innovate quickly enough, it's hard to say. I remember meeting with them 3 years ago and just saying, you know, why haven't you got a SIM in this? You know, yeah. It's the obvious missing link. If you like it, then you should have put a SIM in it. but obviously, what killed the Flip in the long term were smartphones. And especially, look at the iPhone 4, look at the quality of the camera lens in there and the quality of the video that comes out of that. It's really, really good. And I think they didn't keep up with innovation.
Tim, you look sceptical about this allegation.
I loved my Flip camera, I have to say. I'm talking like it's dead, but it's still alive. But there's a couple of things about phones that aren't right yet for me about taking them out. One is the basic form factor. They're too thin for a camera. You need to be able to grasp it like a monkey. And the second thing is obviously battery life. I took my Flip right across Scotland for a project I did. And it runs on, you know, just normal batteries. And it runs for a long time on normal batteries. These things do not, especially my stupid Android HTC. You really don't get much life out of that if you start zooming away at lots of it. So
it's totally true. And smartphones do still have a long way to go. But what they do have is take a video, one button, you know, email it or upload it, which is an incredibly powerful proposition for consumers, and that I think can take more credit than anything else for killing Flip.
Well, there's a couple of things about it that have gone wrong. One, it just hasn't got cheap enough quick enough relative to the other stuff. They're now too expensive, Flips, for what they do. And the second thing is, what do you do with them that you don't, you know, the mobile phones, you use them mainly for just short clips, don't you? And for YouTube sort of clippy type things. And then if you want to do more sort of documentary work, longer form stuff, the Flip's no good because the audio's rubbish and the zoom function.
That's
like
true,
that.
And there's no external mic socket.
No. So what's in between those two activities of clipping and longer form documentary that's so great about for you to do with that thing? It's hard to think what it is.
Yeah, they should have improved the product faster, but they did create a market that previously had been pretty expensive, high-end video cameras that got smaller and smaller, but still were fairly inaccessible to mainstream, to most consumers.
Surely Cisco is a bit short-sighted in thinking that everybody has smartphones, not just in this country, but in the developing world, where flips can be quite useful for digital storytelling and capturing information, don't you think, Tim?
I definitely think that's that's true in sort of rugged environments. You know, if you're out in the desert or you're in sort of somewhere quite sort of dusty and dirty, they're really good for that. I mean, I think the other thing about Cisco is you've got to remember is they're going to be a player in internet TV boxes, aren't they? And I think that's going to suck up a lot of their resource. And that may have been so partly what was going on.
But there's also a rumor that that using the flip technology was simply a prototyping for their video conferencing system.
Yep.
And it sounds you look pretty convinced on that, Tim.
Well, I think, you know, it's reminding me of Hewlett-Packard has always done sort of things where they launch innovative product for a while or they buy into it. And then a few years down the line, all those people are made redundant and they end up making printer products. So there's some relationship between our investment in technology and R&D and then what they actually end up using that technology for, maybe.
In other news, music streaming service Spotify has announced that it's changing its terms of access for customers who are using their free service. The Swedish company, which has had big play in Europe but has yet to make a splash in the US market, offers two tiers of engagement. And from the 1st of May, the free service will allow non-paying customers to play a track only 5 times, and they'll be able to listen to streaming music for only 10 hours per month. Whereas the premium or the subscription customers, they can play a track as often as they like and can enjoy their music playlists streamed without ads. Now, Jemima, what are the details of the new Spotify model?
Just slightly more detailed than you outlined. New Spotify users will be able to get the free service just as it is now for 6 months. So a sort of, you know, here's what you could have won kind of model. From the 1st of May, anyone who signed up on or before the 1st of November can play each track up to 5 times. So if you're discovering new music, I guess that's okay. If there's one song you've got a real earworm for and you want to play it repeatedly all day, as I sometimes do, then you're stuffed. Listening time for free users is going to be limited to 10 hours a month for the first 6 months, which is about 200 tracks. So essentially quite a complicated bundle of user terms, which will immediately make you think, this isn't very user-friendly, why is Spotify doing it?
And does this change? Is this basically motivating people to get to pay the premium subscription?
So what's behind this, of course, is that the music labels, as soon as anything becomes big and successful and they think, damn, we should have come up with it ourselves, oh, well, this is going to impact our business, then they have a lot of leverage with Spotify because they're trying to get deals and licensing with them, and Spotify kind of needs them, especially for these deals that they reportedly have signed in the US but haven't quite launched yet.
Guardian technology editor Charles Arthur has just joined us in the studio. Charles, Jemima's outlined some of the motivations behind Spotify's recent move, mentioning, interestingly enough, the challenges between the European and the US market. How will Spotify's new moves abate the US market's concerns, the US music industry's concerns?
Well, it's really that the US labels in particular, or the licensing to play the music in the US, which is actually what Spotify needs to go into the US, the labels there are saying, we don't like all this free stuff. Free stuff isn't good. Free stuff can never be good, even if they're paying a per-track fee, which they do in Europe, for example, and which I think is actually works worldwide. They just don't like it. They think if people are listening to music, they should be paying for it, even though we have this invention called radio where people don't pay for it. And actually in the US, radio, I think, is pretty much free. There's not actually a reproduction charge if they play on the radio. There is for internet radio.
So how does you may have just been going into this, but how does something like Last.fm or Pandora, which is still a service, a recommendation service in the US, how do they do it?
Last.fm and Pandora are both internet radio. They're not actually. You can't choose what you get to play. What the next track is. You can't create playlists on Last.fm. You can't create playlists on Pandora. You create stations on both. And that is what they are. That's how they sort of elude the record label's steely grasp, is by saying, we're a radio station. We're not actually the big jukebox in the sky at all.
And radio drives music sales. This is what the labels need to grasp. You know, this is the really important thing. Just because it's free, it doesn't mean that you've given it away and that's it, that's the end of the story. It drives promotion, it drives brands, it drives interest in in music generally, I it's really short-sighted. It makes me quite cross.
But the problem for the labels is that they just see their music business in terms of the revenues that they get being, you know, cut by 90% if everyone moves to a streaming service.
Is this just an issue that Spotify is trying to alleviate the music industry, or are they also aware of, you know, the Apple and the Google rumored services, or the Amazon Cloud Player service that was just announced?
Well, it's very rumored that Amazon has done its Cloud Drive service, which sort of lets you sort of play MP3s in a way that, again, eludes the record companies. If you've already bought them.
Yeah.
And if you sort of upload them, or else if they're sort of sitting there on the Amazon server because you bought them off Amazon. Google is very much rumored to be doing a cloud service, same with Apple. But Apple and Google can't get the labels to sign. That is the problem. So Spotify isn't sort of gaining a march on any of these. Spotify has exactly the same problem. So to some extent, Spotify in the US is in exactly the same place as Google and Apple and anyone else who wants to play. You know, they just can't get the labels to do the sign because the labels think we'd rather sell CDs than to get, you know, the little bits of money that we might get from cloud play.
They're asking for too much money for what they're offering in the first place. I mean, I found this working both independently and through people like the BBC, is that as soon as, for example, an actor's agent gets the idea that there's going to be a drama that plays out on the internet and have, you know, X 100,000 plays, they want a kind of more money than they'd get for doing a TV episode because they think it's a bigger audience, even though it isn't. So there's a whole level of representation of artists who just are too greedy and also don't really understand the dynamics of how an audience interacts with a piece. So that's just a big problem of the economics. I mean, I grew up with DIY punk, right? And I think there's a funny moment here that's not unlike the move from prog rock to punk and new wave. I think there's a real opportunity here for young artists to think about themselves in a proper transmedia type of way of thinking, I need to join up my free with my charge, with my live, with my video, and think about myself as a multimedia artist.
Finally this week, the British entrepreneur Ian Dodsworth is reportedly in advanced talks with the microblogging service Twitter for the sale of his successful third-party application, TweetDeck, for $50 million. TweetDeck, which Tech Weekly profiled in 2009, is a Twitter client that allows users to follow their connections away from the browser. Its unique selling point, however, is that users can sort their friends and followers by subject area, making the often fire hose of information more consumable according to the personal preference. Now, Jemima, what are the details that we know right now of this this alleged sale?
Well, the point to emphasize is that this is not signed. So this is just a reported sale. But it was only a very short time ago that Uber Media has been going around. They've had a bit of a clash with Twitter about buying up sort of the best Twitter services. And they put in an offer for about 30 million. And now Twitter reportedly is offering them 50 million. So, you know, good job holding out, Ian, because you've clearly bumped
it up.
An extra
20, that's, you know, that'll be good for the pocket.
Yeah, that's good. The wider story here is that Twitter's strategy has changed as it's got more mature and it's had to focus on where it's going to get its money from. So it spent 4 years building this very interesting ecosystem and now it's cherry-picking the best.
I was going to ask, actually, why TweetDeck? Because it's already got its own client.
Well, they bought Tweety. They turned that into the official Twitter app, which is amazing. And it has some nice features in it, but it's essentially a simple Twitter client. TweetDeck is much higher end. It's for the power user. I mean, I live and breathe on Twitter, as I'm sure I've bored you with many times, and I find it a bit much. It's a bit bossy. You know, I like to have Twitter in the corner of the screen if I'm using it on desktop as a kind of extra selection of voices. I don't like to have to go into Twitter, take up the full screen, have, you know, five different columns. It doesn't work for me like that. But it works for a lot of people, and it's very well done. So, yeah. Good job to them. I hope they sign the deal.
I think it'd be interesting to know whether this is going to be a cash deal or a share deal or some mixture of that. Because if it's shares, well, it's sort of $50 million, sort of.
They're like the Emperor's New Clothes we were talking
about
earlier.
Yeah, exactly. But if it's cash, well, interesting that Twitter has got $50 million hanging around and, you know, sitting in a bank account. I would have thought it's going to be some sort of mixture of cash and shares.
Mm.
More on these stories and other news all week at guardian.co.uk/technology. Human beings have been telling stories for millennia. It's the way that we communicate our cultures and express our identities. Storytelling takes an enormous number of forms, from verbal in song to words on a page to photographs and, of course, the moving image. We tell stories through all of our senses, through sound, smell, taste, touch and sight. Yet, for the past approximately 150 years, the dominant form of storytelling has been linear media, a box or a screen leading us, like the Pied Piper's children, along a single narrative path. A few people have tried to break this mold. Newspapers in the early 20th century, for example, left readers clues for a national treasure hunt that spanned different papers, radio programs, and billboards. Books like Kit Williams' Masquerade left clues in the illustrations that accompanied the text, sending 1970s British kids around empty fields with shovels, hoping to dig up a box of glory. Now, more recently, with the advent of interactive technologies like the web, traditional media creatives have become more innovative with the ways that they tell stories. Wired editor Frank Rose has been watching this trend unfold since reporting on the scene first in 2007. He and I recently spoke about this new art of immersion when he came to The Guardian to talk about his new book, which has the name The Art of Immersion. I began by asking him what's led to this transformation in the storytelling process.
The technology of the internet is, changing the way we approach stories, and it's really kind of inevitable. I mean, you know, we've lived for the past until a few years ago, we had lived for 100-120 years in mass media, you know, broadcasting, whether it was television or print or whatever. It was the same thing. It was really, you know, one-way communication. And, you know, kind of the most we could do with each other was get together and talk about it occasionally, you know, hence the water cooler. And this is entirely different. What's really interesting, I think, is that the kind of multi-way conversation and involvement and so forth that it makes possible is really something that people have always wanted to do. It's just whether the technology enables it or not.
One of the things that I really liked when you were in your book, The Art of Immersion, is you were talking about how there is no end point to story online. It's this notion that you can go down a rabbit hole, as Alice did in
right.
Wonderland.
Right.
You can go down a rabbit hole, and then if you discover that there isn't any more to the story, you yourself can write it. How much do you think that people will engage with that process, though? Surely people do want endpoints. They want, you know, the payoff, the conclusion, the thank you very much. I can now go home and feel satisfied that I've been knitted a beautiful yarn by somebody else.
It's funny. I among the people I interviewed for the book are Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, the guys who ran Lost. And, you know, I talked with them about this, and what they said was people that they talked to wanted to know if they could have, you know, a say in where the story went. You know, how can we sort of shape it and direct it? And at the same time, they also wanted to be reassured that the producers, that Damon and Carlton, knew where the story was going. And they said that, you know, these are kind of, it's very hard to have both. In fact, I think it's possible, and I think Lost did it. You know, Lost was such an incredibly convoluted story that people had to get together online to just to figure it out. And also because it was a serial and one that was kind of consciously open to outside input. I mean, they listened very hard to their fans. They didn't certainly always do what their fans wanted.
So how do authors of immersive stories grapple with and consolidate this notion of the multiple audiences who are engaging in these quite different ways?
You know, it's really a problem. And there's, you know, it hasn't been solved very well yet. Cameron explained it to me as, you know, this kind of storytelling, this sort of immersive storytelling, as wanting to be able to go deeper, almost like a fractal experience. If you were a casual viewer, you could just watch the movie. If you were a more committed fan, you could jump in powers of 10 and the pattern would still hold. But actually doing it is, you know, quite a bit harder. You know, how do you carry the story forward in, you know, one medium without, you know, leaving behind the other people? But, you know, it's an issue.
I wonder how much of a danger there is in the advertising and marketing companies co-opting this this experience of using the web. And in doing that, the marketers and the advertisers will oversaturate, and this immersive storytelling will simply become a gimmick that then goes by the wayside. How can we make sure that that doesn't happen?
I think if the marketing people are smart enough, they'll make sure it doesn't happen. A lot of what has happened with alternate reality games is, you know, there's really no way to pay for them. You can't charge money for them. And so therefore, for the most part, they've been, you know, marketing either add-ons or offshoots or whatever. Not entirely. I mean, you know, when Trent Reznor did the Year Zero experience, he paid for it himself, and he did so because he wanted to tell the story that was, you know, behind that album. It's just like brand involvement in any kind of story. If the brand is smart and they know when to get out of the way and what to do and what not to do, it can work.
How do you tell people who are interested, people who come up to you and want to tell stories through these ways? How do you explain to them the affordances of the different media? What would you say is, for example, an affordance of Twitter or an affordance of social media in general versus a website, a blog?
I think it entirely depends. But I think the thing that's most important and almost the only thing that's important is that the story itself has to be good. The story has to be involving enough that people want to experience it in different media. And, you know, if it's not, all the transmedia in the world is not going to save it. I think that obviously there are some fun things that you can do with, you know, with Twitter, say. I mean, even if you're not doing it yourself, I mean, that's what happened with Mad Men. People in the advertising business or with a background in the advertising business kind of jumped into it and established themselves as Twitter characters and took it very seriously, took their roles incredibly seriously. You know, I spoke to the person who, among other people, I spoke to the person who tweeted as Betty Draper, and she spent hours and hours every week researching what Betty Draper, like what her kitchen was like, you know, what her whole life was like, her existence in suburbia.
It seems to be that the role of the storyteller is not just to create the narrative, but also to cultivate the superfan, the rise yes. and rise of the superfan. And how do you sort of stop superfans necessarily from getting into your narrative?
You don't. That's what Matthew Weiner discovered with Mad Men. Ultimately, you can't say no. They tried to. AMC, the network that commissioned it and broadcast it in the U.S., shut off these Twitter accounts or had Twitter shut them off. And there was such a huge uproar that Deep Focus, their digital marketing agency, came to them and said, you can't do this. This is not going to work. You have fans who are so involved in the show that they want to take a role in it, essentially. And why would you shut that off? These are your biggest fans. Ultimately, there is no control. It's something that everybody has to learn in the media business, whether you're an advertiser, whether you're an ad agency, whether you're a creative person, whether you're work at a network. There is no control. You can't tell people what to do and what not to do. All you can do is sort of throw stuff out there and experiment. And what we're seeing now is a lot of really, really great experiments, some of which work and some of which don't.
That was Frank Rose, author of Art of Immersion. And Tim, who is the actual author in modern storytelling projects?
I don't think you ever get away from the idea that there's a central writer or a team of writers who have sort of specced out that story world and kind of know where it's going. I think from just hearing that bit that Frank had said about that, the expectation of the audience is that there is somebody who kind of knows roughly where we're going, or maybe has improvisation skills to sort of get us back on track if we all drift off into sort of a world of discursive nonsense, you know, and rein it back in. So I think that we talk sometimes in these things about ringmasters and that kind of thing, of somebody who's sort of defined the kind of parameters of the story world like a circus ring and then sits in the middle and makes sure that the things that happen inside the ring kind of make sense. So I think you don't get away from the idea that there might be a controlling intelligence.
Something out there, I can imagine.
That might be, in the future, an artificial intelligence that starts botting its way around your story.
Do you actually think that, you know, we will get rid of the... Well, God, this sounds really dramatic. We'll get rid of the author and the storyteller forever.
Yeah, well, I did a project 10, 11, 12 years ago called Online Caroline, where we wrote the character. She's basically a woman playing out a story in a webcam, and it was seemingly live, even though we'd sort of filmed it in advance, and then got the code to spit out the scenes at the right moment. And then she would write to any viewer who signed up to be her friend. And that was really a collection of paragraphs that I had written, and then we put into a database. But they were based on personalization, so it could watch what you'd clicked, what you'd viewed. If you told her your name, your gender, your age, where you lived, how many kids you had, it would she would talk to you differently. So my job as the writer then was simply to load the database with the appropriate responses to any form of engagement and then sit back and do nothing. So and watch people respond.
There's not a lot of money going around at the minute for projects like this. We recently witnessed the Arts Council funding cuts and the impact that had on innovative projects like this is ricocheted around these communities. So what is digital art and digital storytelling in the art of in the age of austerity that we're experiencing, Tim?
Well, it's funny you say there's not a lot of money because, you know, it seems to me the reason why, you know, someone like Frank is writing a book about it is the fact that industries like the Hollywood industry and advertisers are really jumping on it, actually. If you want to be a storyteller funded by those kinds of businesses, I think there's never been a better time. Maybe the independent sector of sort of arts-based storytelling is struggling, but actually transmedia storytelling is a very sort of trendy and interesting thing for people to do. In terms of where I get my money, I mean, I do apply to arts funds. I do sort of teach a bit. And I do work for broadcasters and brands on their projects. But I tend to then spend any money I make on that kind of commercial stuff on my own stupid projects, so, which I give away for free.
One of the shortcomings, I think, of a lot of the transmedia that we've seen is that especially the big splashes have been treasure hunts. You know, they've used those types of gimmicks to compel people to into this magic circle. It's, you know, an ultimate payoff. So how can people who are immersed in digitalia, immersed in technology, use the different technologies to create compelling narratives that don't just have those payoffs? What other types of stories are out there that don't involve digging up a field or you know, looking for a golden owl somewhere?
Yeah, definitely. Treasure hunts is one. Women in distress is always a good meme as well, I find, that they need to be saved. That seems to happen a lot. I did a project called In Search of Olton, which was about building an imaginary town out of people's memories of their childhood or a place that they couldn't get back to or a person they'd lost. And it allowed people to add story elements to a landscape and to a community and build it up and then sort of make it feel real. So you could say, I remembered the sweet shop. Add a story or even a photograph or any kind of media you liked. And then the sweet shop would then appear on the map and we would extend the world. And then I, as the sort of, again, this idea of the sort of controlling intelligence, created a story about my dad travelling through that landscape that everybody had co-created. And we did that as a radio play and as a online piece. And I think people like talking about themselves and they like exploring themselves through these things. I think quite a lot of going to the computer and playing around with games and stories is quite often about an act of self-definition, and how definitely blogging and Twitter is. So I think those kinds of things plugged into stories can be a really good hook. And lost things is treasure hunt, but that idea of being able to commemorate yourself and things about yourself, allowing people to, you know, explore their own creativity in a way that feels safe, that doesn't feel too naff, that somebody isn't going to come and criticize you too hard, that it doesn't matter, that you could probably delete it and it wouldn't go missing. All those kinds of things are really quite interesting rules and techniques for getting people involved in participative storytelling. Maybe not interactive, but participative.
There was a Johnny Cash video made last year, which was collaborative. So everyone uploaded an animation and it would play a different randomly selected scene, which was a really interesting example of using technology for collaboration. And also Arcade Fire's Wilderness Downtown, where you put in a postcode and it would use your childhood home. Didn't work for me because it had been demolished, but anyway, added an extra little dash of nostalgia to it. Any other examples or even suggestions of good practice for which tools you can use to engage people in that kind of way?
I got involved last year in the RSC Such Tweet Sorrow. I was the lead writer and designer of that. And I was quite surprised that that worked, even though I was part of it. Definitely people felt that they could... there were some people who wanted to develop their own characters or become extras in that piece. And they definitely wanted to sort of participate through things like Tumblr blogs and Posterous, of adding their own sort of ideas of how they think this production should play out, what it should look like. Like when we went to the party, what music should be played and what kind of masks get worn, and even the kind of language that got used. You know, there was a lot of criticism about the fact that it wasn't poetry. Duh.
And of course, the project itself was a Romeo and Juliet told via Twitter. And
yes,
so therefore,
it was, yeah.
Therefore,
yeah.
There was a certain element of poetry expected, perhaps.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. God, can you imagine that? If you've been Shakespeare and every time you turn up, everyone says, well, we're expecting quite a high level of poetry from you today. It's just bollocks, that criticism, frankly, especially when you're doing it on Twitter. And then you look at what the audience want to do with it. They are really interested in experimenting textually with the way that they talk to the characters and they write them. They also did want to kind of toy around with the story. Like, they knew that Mercutio's going to die, right? And we know that Romeo's going to die.
Movie wrecker! Spoiler alert.
And yet they started a campaign for Save Mercutio. Like, we were all going to turn around and go, you know what? Yeah, let's let him live. In fact, we'll send him around your house, shall we? You know, so there was that tension between knowing that this story is interactive and no, it's not. It's actually really interesting in itself about why people participate.
Well, you can buy a copy of Art of Immersion at guardianbookshop.co.uk, and you'll be able to hear the whole interview with Frank at guardian.co.uk/untanglingtheweb in a few weeks' time when I tackle storytelling for my Observer column. That's it for this week. Thanks to Charles and to Tim and to Jemima for their in-studio genius, and to Frank Rose. Next week, we are exploring the place where technology and art intersect, a new web service, Art Finder. Now, before we go, there have been some really great listener responses to the question that we asked last week. What is serendipity? Jin Brogues Hats reckons he got to where he is today through serendipity. He said on Twitter, "Serendipity has got me way further than talent or hard work." Kev J. Wills says, "Serendipity is a fortunate confluence, things coming together advantageously." And David Hay says, "Serendipity is the accidental discovery of value." I'm collecting more of these definitions on the serendipityengine.tumblr.com, so do keep sending them in. And also, tell us about your favorite serendipitous encounter. All of this is part of the research that I'm doing for a forthcoming Untangling the Web column for The Observer 2. Links are on the blog. The producer of this week's podcast was Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Kratosky. We're back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.